Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Today, we have a special guest on, and I'm going to introduce and welcome our guest, Steph Turner, who will be speaking out about the roller coaster journey life has taken Steph through. Injustices that she has had to endure, her struggles, and now achievements. Steph, after going to prison for a crime she did not commit, became an activist. She earned her college degrees and has recently written a book. But I'm going to save time and let our guest speak. Steph Turner, let's welcome Stephanie. Steph, are you with us?
Yes, thank you.
How are you today?
Well, other than the cold, I'm doing fine. At least
well,
it's not Omicron.
I want to welcome you on the show. And there's so much information that you have to offer. And again, I recently learned that Steph has obtained so many degrees. And so we'll let Steph talk about it. But please do start talking about your situation and how you came to be on the show and how you came to get all these degrees.
Okay. So let's go back to 1993. Early 1993, I was coming out as transgender to some family members, and primarily to my transgender sister, who did not know that I too was transgender, because until then I was not ready to be out or even to admit that word transgender could describe what I was experiencing. So as I came out to her, I remember writing her a bunch of letters. And we had a phone call in early February that year, and we had a good long talk. And for her, suddenly a lot of things started to make sense. Well, she had some prior record from things she did when she was younger. And so she was living in this one little studio apartment in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, and she had lost that apartment when the place that she was working for decided that they didn't no longer need her services. So she was going to be homeless. So I allowed her to move in with me because at the time I was separated from my wife, trying to sort through all the codependency issues surrounded, anchored in my transgender experience and repression. So she moved in with me. And then a month later, a neighborhood girl was gawking in the window at her. And next, you know, the next day she's still staring at her and finds her way into my apartment, which my apartment I was sharing with my sister. She had the front room. I slept in the back. Well, shorten the story, she accuses my sister of all kinds of heinous stuff, and then we're waiting to figure out what to do about it, but then I get accused of it too. And this is, keep in mind, the early 1990s was at the height of the sex abuse panic. This is also a time when most people had never even heard of the word transgender. And there was popular assumption, especially among the conservative Republicans, that if they're transgender or queer, they must be sexual predators of some kind. So it was very easy for this young person to be coaxed into creating all these bizarre accusations, because that was going on a lot at the time. And then it was very easy for us to then be found guilty. So I took it to trial. We both went to trial, separate juries, but it was the same trial. And we both ended up found guilty, even though there was no corroborating evidence. I mean, I was quite confident I'd be found acquitted until the lawyer, and she was doing a good job trying to work for my benefit. She pointed out in the law book the statement that has always stuck with me. No corroborating evidence is necessary for a conviction of CSE. This is the state of Michigan. I got a quick education to the corrupt nature of the criminal justice system. We were both, even though we were both out transgender, I quickly detransitioned, and we were both sent to a men's prison. That was in early 1994. In 2001, my sister, Janet, her name is Janet, but her preferred name is Janet. I get a message from her. Or actually, I get a message from my sister and my mother who visit me, who tells me that she does not have much long to live. She had lung cancer related to the brain. I had one day to write a letter to say goodbye. And then a week later, I get the response that the doctor had read her the letter in this prison hospital. And then hours later, she had walked on.
Oh,
American, and we use walked on as one of the metaphors for passing away.
Yes. You know something? I'm really sorry to hear that. Now, I want to bring up something, Steph, before you go any further.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things sis. I, years ago, when I first started my organization, New Vision Organization, we were doing national work. And I think I mentioned to you, I helped this girl. She was transgender. She was from the Middle East. She was Persian, Lebanese, and Egyptian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people don't understand, and I know you're going to be discussing this further, but people do not understand what transgenders go through, because unfortunately they don't understand that people can be, and if they go back into, and I'm the type of person that really studies the Bible, and common sense would tell a lot of people that you know, these things started out from the beginning of the Bible. But the problem is, when I worked with the GLBTs, the gays, the lesbians, you know, they would talk about what they go through. But this trans that I worked with told me, she said, what makes it difficult when somebody is with someone that's gay or lesbian, they know what they are.
Mm.
But when someone meets an individual and they fall in love with this person, and then the person finds out, and then it becomes very, very dangerous and damaging. But people, I watched this show one time where they had this 11-year-old child. I think it was Barbara Walters or Diane Sawyer. And the child was, she was in school. She was on a girl soccer team.
Mm.
And she was a boy that, you know, was a trans. And so they were talking to her about, you know, how do the teachers treat you? How do the kids? And she said that they treated her normal. Everybody treated her like she was a girl. And and her parents, you know, understood what she was going through. And but so Diane Sawyer, at the end of the interview, Diane Sawyer said, what do you think is going to happen when you get older? And that little girl turned around and she said, I'm just going to have to deal with it when that time comes.
Mm.
But, you know, it shows that that child, and because there's so much violence connected with GLBTs, no one is going to make up stories. No one is going to try to be something they're not,
right,
especially when it can be so dangerous. So I hope that the audience listening will understand that when someone is feeling that they're not right in the gender that they were born into, or people assume they're born into, it's not because they're making it up, because people are born into, you know, this girl that I helped, she was a trans, she was a twin, and she and her sister were born, they were twins, the sister came out one way, she came out the same way, but different organs. So
right.
I just think it's very important for the public to know, and I want the public, the audience also to know that Steph Turner is an author, and she's a founder of an ecology, and she is going to be talking about that too. But there's so much involved in this, and this is why I'm so honored to have her on the show, because she is going to be bringing awareness to a lot of people that do not understand these types of situations. So, Steph, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'd like to have you finish, talk more about what you were discussing.
Well, sure. And just a follow-up on that very point, and that is your audience may not be aware that while it's easier now to be out as transgender, and you there's far more social support, there are people who are incarcerated only on the thinnest of accusations, or targeted by the police, or all kinds of cruel things done to them, who are still enduring the repercussions, the consequences of that rejection decades ago. And I'm living proof of one of those people who endures that legacy of rejection and harsh using the criminal justice system to enforce a moral code that turned out to be immoral of all kinds.
Exactly. And it's happened. And that the young lady that I was trying to help back then, she went through the same thing. And it was unfortunate that she had to endure such pain.
Yes, and I think, too, also in the Muslim community, they're a little bit in a different place than, say, the modern Christian world and of the West. They're a little bit kind of dragged along, where those in the Muslim community are probably still struggling on how do we, you know, interpret this whole GLBT experience. Isn't that just something from the West? We don't like the West. I mean, typically some media some people from the Middle East are that way, while others in the Middle East are like, well, wait a minute, the message of Islam is peace, and it's very adjustable to modern ways of living. So, yeah, so it's quite a good, I'm sure she's gone through some challenges I never had to face.
Yeah. But we have a caller, 307. Hold on, I'm going to take you off of mute. 307, you want to state your name, please?
Stephen Carpenter.
Stephen?
Okay, yeah.
Stephen, welcome. What would you like to say?
Right now I'm just listening, but I will speak up when I feel like I need to, I guess.
Okay, I'm going to, I will leave you off mute, but I'm going to, if any distractions come or if anyone else comes on, I'm going to keep it on mute so that Steph can tell the story. So I'm sorry, Steph, continue with where we left off.
Okay, so somewhere after my sister had passed away, I had to continue on, soldier on my own. We were already in different facilities already. And so at some point, I became aware of a publication called TIP Journal, T-I-P, which was just short for transsexual in prison. Transsexual was a term back then. It's not used in use anymore. But there was as I got close to my time to be discharged in 2005, the editor had said, you know, she needed to move on. Who's going to be able to take over? And I already have experience as being an editor, so I was nominated. But by the time I did get out, that did not really shape up. But what did shape up was that I became the editor of a quarterly newsletter that was for and by transgender inmates around spirituality. And we had quite a diversity, those who were a Christian, those who are atheists. I even had a Satanist. And this was quite a diversity of spirituality. Who can communicate on the common ground what it's like to be transgender and in prison? So I got out and I was part of this publication while I returned to school. So I was finishing up my bachelor's degree at Oakland University, just north of Detroit. While I'm doing the school and getting good grades, I was also the editor of this quarterly publication in keeping inmates being able to, transgender inmates, to be able to communicate with one another for peer support, basically, and using spirituality as that bridge. Well, one of them was like wondering what they're going to do when they were discharged. They happened to be the Satanist. And so I ended up letting her come home where I live to start a new program, a pioneering program called Trans Action. And it was the first pilot program for reentry for transgender ex-prisoners. Now, after a year of this, I kind of realized I was over my head, and I was finishing up, I had already finished up my undergrad in sociology, anthropology, so I decided I should go back to school and get a degree in public administration with an emphasis in nonprofit management, and I did that for the next 3 years, but by then, my focus had shifted. I went back to school and got a master's degree in counseling. Now, one of the other things I was doing, going back to school all the time, is because of my record of having this so-called sex offense record, even though I didn't do anything to earn it, I was actually unable to find work. So I actually used the student loans and financial aid I was receiving through my tribal grant to be able to get through those years, hoping I would someday be able to get a job. Still waiting. So that's kind of where I'm at right now, is waiting for the courts to finally recognize the mistake. Fortunately, though, Michigan now has a conviction integrity unit statewide. I want to assume your audience knows what a conviction integrity unit. If not, want me to quick explain?
Yes, I would. I'd love to have you explain, because I did not even know what it was until I had learned from you earlier.
Okay. So about 1990, you know, is when we start getting DNA testing, and then a couple of guys down in New York school, you probably know them, they formed the Innocence Project. And then a few years later, they started popping up all over the country. So about now, every state has at least one Innocence Project. Well, then down in Houston, or is it either Houston or Dallas? I always forget which. But down in Texas, in 2007, a prosecutor, a black prosecutor who had like compassion for the black men who were being wrongly convicted, he was kind of thinking like, why do we always have these nonprofit organizations embarrassing us? So he started the first conviction integrity unit. Well, if you know how the justice does not work in the United States, it's all at the county level. So if you had one there in, say, Dallas, well, what's going to be happening to those who are wrongly convicted in Austin, or those who are wrongly convicted in Armadillo or Lubbock? So it's still at the county level. So eventually now, and I just found out like a year ago, Michigan, which only had the one in Detroit at that point, had started a statewide conviction integrity unit. Now, I don't know quite know how it operates, because once they actually review it, they still have to go down to the county, the county level for the district court. But I think, you know, it's a higher level. It's the district attorney of Michigan. So they took up my case back in May. I just got a letter just 2 days ago saying they are handing off my case to the Innocence Project in West Michigan. So at least I know what's going on. I was like left in the dark. And so one of the things I first met you, Leona, is because I had created, talk about activism, I had created a spreadsheet application called the Estimated Innocence Form. What that does is allow anyone who downloads the form to fill in the questions, and if their case ends up correlating very closely to other exonerated cases, they could have an independent verification of how viable their innocence is, rather than waiting on these lawyers who take forever and sometimes don't even respond or say, sorry, we can't look at your case now because we're still helping someone on death row. And yes, you're already out of prison, so sorry. Well, that's not acceptable. There are, I've estimated up to 300,000 innocent prisoners, and even more if you count those who are already outside of prison. And when I say innocent, I mean actual innocence. There are probably many more who are wrongly convicted, but yet, you know, one of their minor offenses they actually did, or maybe they did some other offense. So that story, that's a whole other area of justice. But there's the fact that there are those who are wrongly convicted and had no involvement whatsoever in the crime, and like myself, no criminal history at all. So that estimated innocence form can give these people a hope, so that they can have some document to show, like a renter or a potential employer, say, no, don't just go by the background check. Look, find this as empirical evidence, because the court doesn't provide empirical evidence. So, and I also addressed that a couple of years ago too. Well, maybe it's close to 3 or 4 years. I wrote a bill called the Informed Decision Act, IDA for short, Informed Decision Act. And what this does is compel the courts, when they provide their data for, like, okay, this person was convicted of a sex offense, or this person was convicted of homicide, or this person was convicted of breaking and entering, they have to also provide other context. Like, for example, did the person forego a parole board hearing and just said, I'll go ahead and discharge because I'm not going to admit to something I did not do? Did this person maintain innocence throughout their whole thing? Did they go to trial? At any time, did they take any plea? So all these different pieces of information can help a background check realize that these aren't black and white. Just because someone has a criminal history, a record, does not mean they have a criminal history. I presented this. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm going to go back to the young lady that I tried to help in the past. This was about 12 years ago. Her name was Sharuti, but we called her Promethea. And she had been abused severely when she was with her father in the Middle East in Lebanon. And she, not only she, but her siblings as well, she came over to this country, and she was in Canada. Apparently, she didn't have paperwork, but she was hitchhiking to the United States. And she got picked up by a truck driver. Now, the truck driver, as I say, she was very beautiful. She was 5'4". She was like 94 pounds and long, silky hair. And the truck driver driving those 18-wheelers had a weapon in his glove compartment, and he tried to rape her. So what he did, when he was trying to get her in the back of the cab, the gun was on the seat. So she took the gun, and she shot him in his thigh, and she jumped out of the truck, and she ran. However, she did get caught, and the truck driver, who was the perpetrator, ended up, you know, accusing her of trying to shoot him. And so she went to prison for 14 years. She went to a female prison. She was at a female prison for months before they realized that, you know, that organ, of course. So they sent her to a male prison. She was incarcerated in a male prison in Iowa for 14 years, and she had been beaten and abused and raped so many times that Priya had to go. But for people in the audience that are not aware of Priya, Priya is a Prison Rape Elimination Act, where they send in this group, these investigators, when there's a history or there's discussion of someone being raped. Promethea, they had found that she had been raped by over 800 and something prisoners, including gang members. Hmm. She tried to kill herself by jumping off a top tier while being raped, and she landed on the ground floor, and she had not died. They dragged her at the bottom. They dragged her in the cell, and all over again, she went through it. When she was released, I worked it out with her counselor to have her come to Massachusetts, and I took her to the hospital because she was still bleeding, and the bleeding never stopped, and the doctor tried to examine her, but she was in so much pain that the doctor had a difficult time, you know, doing the testing and everything. But what happened is with Promethea, I was able to get her connected with counselors. I was able to get her connected with it was in Boston where they worked with gays and lesbians and trans, and she was doing really good. Unfortunately, she met someone, and he was a painter, and he was very interested in her, and they became friends. And she was actually working with them. She was so happy because she had a job. She was working with him. But apparently, at some point in time, she knew she had to tell him. And when she told him, he told her that he was shocked. He was really shocked because he didn't know. But he didn't beat her. But as a result, at another time where she was out in the street, and she just would go out there and she'd listen to her earphones, her radio, and she was, even the police, they got to know her. They knew about her situation. And they just left her alone because she never bothered anyone. But these three men, they got her in a building and they tried to kill her when they found out about her. And she was thrown out of a third floor building and landed on a vehicle. Again, she was taken to the hospital, but she ended up hitchhiking to California because she felt that she would be around people more like her and that, you know, would be safe. Unfortunately, because she didn't have her paperwork, she was deported. But I just want people in society to know, everybody's so focused on someone's culture, someone's race, someone's religion, someone's gender. And it's so unnecessary because we all are sinners and we don't know the complete anything, history of anything. Just like they say in the Old Testament of the Bible, you know, you if you murder someone, then you die. But then again, why did God forgive Moses? Moses was a murderer. King David, these are popular people in the Bible. Right. He was a murderer, you know, and even Saul, who later became the Apostle Paul, all murderers. We don't understand the Bible because when people look at this Bible, they're looking at something that fits in their hand. They're not looking at something that went on for thousands of years. And when Adam and Eve were first born, what happened? They had children. Who did their children marry? They married their own siblings. That's how this world was formed. And so when people try to judge someone because of their gender, they need to know all the facts. Because I have seen and heard of too many people because of their gender, race, or religion, too many people suffer because of a judgmental society. And what you went through, and I'm going to let you finish what you were saying, but what you went through, and I'm sure you probably still go through it at times, but to get your degrees that you, and I want you to talk something about the degrees, but then I also would love to have you speaking about this anecology, because that is very important to get the awareness out, to understand more about this type of culture.
Yeah, thanks to my sister Janet. She was actually the first one in my family to really pave the way to dig into our Native American heritage. Because I grew up thinking, of course, now the joke is, oh, what part is it? My left knee? My right foot? You know, I'm all Native American, and I'm also the part Caucasian part. They're integrated. So as she led that path for me, and now she's gone, I took and followed that path too, and I started transitioning my spirituality from a Christian background to more of a Native American spirituality. And along the way, in 1994, I got involved with the Indian Nations United. That's, you know, the club name for those who are inside, even though we don't always embrace the word Indian or even Native American, as, you know, Chupa points out. You know, we're people of Turtle Island. So those are just names that we have to put up with, because that's otherwise how else people will know us. So I got more involved in that club, and I also got more involved in reading. And then this one article that always stuck with me was by this author named Don Coyes. Now, Don Coyes went on to start the Wellbriety movement, which is actually helping helping indigenous brothers and sisters around North America, there's that word again, around Turtle Island, in order to overcome the patterns of addiction and alcohol and other abuse that has really been a pattern since the days of the school boarding era, which many of our elders themselves personally endured. And so he wrote this article and inspired me to really rethink about a lot of things I had learned. That really paved the way for what for me later became onychology. Onychology comes from the Greek word onyche, which is the classic Greek word for need, probably still the contemporary Greek word, but I have training in classic Greek. And when my first time I went to school back, a long time ago. So I knew that onyche was need. So I realized that really what we need best to observe is not society for sociology. Then you just look at society, the big picture, or psychology. They look at the small picture of what's in the mind and behavior, and there's a bias towards what individuals do, which is a very Western bias, missing the big picture. And economics, that's a social science too, but they look at only the transactions in economic terms. They still miss a lot of things. So I was inspired to come up with a social science that looks at all things. There's this phrase in Anishinaabe, and I'm very much in Anishinaabe culture, the Native American or the Turtle Island people of Michigan, Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Odawa. And they have a phrase that says, we look in all directions. Wasa in Abadah. We look in all directions. So we kind of acknowledge all things. In fact, there's even a passage in the book of Proverbs that says, acknowledge him in all your ways, and he will direct your path. That kind of idea is like, don't ignore reality, or even in the black community. Keep it 100%. But how often we avoid something. So in the book, I even address avoidance as something that we get caught up in, because the human brain is wired to avoid pain that's overwhelming. And modernity has taught us that we should just avoid pain, but then it builds up too much. We have to deal with it when it first comes. So I ended up writing a book about this whole idea of onychology. It actually started as a series of blog posts and some articles I wrote. So I put it together in a book. I hope to have the book published in about 2 weeks.
Great.
What's the book called?
You Need This. So it's kind of keep it simple. You Need This. And need in all capital N-E-D.
And all right, and out of for you, do you consider yourself two-spirited?
That's a good question, because when I started coming out in the early 90s, and I was going deep into Native American, again, I'm going to use that word because that's what people are familiar with, that may be what could help me to answer myself. And I did for a minute, but then I realized what I'm really experiencing is something distinct. And I also point this out in the book. I actually consider myself as trans spirit. Two-spirit is more a tradition that really goes back to tribal cultures and an experience that each tribe in their culture had for their situation at their moment throughout, their time. And I found my experience was somewhat distinct. I'm not putting down two-spirit. That's, in a way it does speak to me somewhat. But I found myself compelled to transcend not only the gender binary, but to transcend the political binary. I'm neither progressive, liberal, nor conservative. I transcend above it, and I can relate to the needs on both sides, and I see both sides overgeneralizing too much, and that's why they're stuck in division, conflict. I also see both sides of the judiciary divide, the accused and accuser. Also, a problem within the criminal judicial system is that they have this division imposed on people whose experience do not fit neatly into these judicial boxes of, defendant and a plaintiff. The reality is far more complex. So in the book, I address that too.
Nice, because I've been listening, and usually I just listen and not say anything, but for some reason, you're really sticking out to me. Me, myself, I'm in recovery also. So when I heard you talk about Wellbriety, I was like, I just got out of class. I did my Wellbriety class. I just worked through step four. But me, myself, I am a 32-year-old Native American. I consider myself two-spirited because and I'm from Wyoming, the Wind River Reservation, and where I'm from, it still looks down upon to even be that way. But there's so many people around here that are, you know, there's so many people that kill themselves because they can't be themselves.
Yeah.
And so I feel the need to exercise both spirits, my feminine and masculine, and being
right.
Native, found out about the two spirit. It really, it made me more proud to be who I am and how I am and to exercise all of me. So when you were talking about trans and all that, I was just like, oh, wow, then you're Native and then you're talking about recovery. I just really felt attached to you and I felt like I needed to say something because all those were peaks. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I need to say something because that's cool. So that's why you said you wrote a book. So I wrote that down. So I'd be looking forward to when it comes out.
Oh, good.
I want to thank you. I want to thank you for saying that. What was your name again? I'm sorry, your first name again?
Steven?
The caller? Steven. Steven, I want to thank you because what you just said is so true. There have been so many suicides, so many people that have committed suicide because they can't fit in. They have trouble trying to find out why they're the way they are. But you both mentioned that you're Native Indians as well, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and Steph, you had mentioned that you listened to Chinupa a lot. I believe Chinupa might be on with us. Chinupa, are you on with us?
Yes, I just caught my nephew and the other brother talking about, you know, the two-spirit side, and, you know, I understand the nature of it. Let me jump in here, if you don't mind, sister. It's great to be remembered. I really honor that guy for reminding himself of Chinupa because a lot of things in Indian country, and my nephew Steven, I always try to get him to get on the shows to express more of his health because he's going through a lot of, you know, drastic change in his life. In our culture, the Lakota people in general, okay, we have what we call a wink day. Wink day. If you were to spell a wink day, it would be like in English, it'd be W-I-N-K, wink day. So you put that K next to the T-E, T-E, day, okay? So in reality, in lateral terms, people don't understand this. A wink day, which is people that in modern speaking, because we all use in English, you know, you call them a fag, a gay, a homosexual, whatever. The name is that Americans bastardized their language to describe somebody. But in Native culture, for us indigenous people in Turtle Island here, the wink there was highly regarded. He was honorable. And I'll tell you why. The wink there, if you break it down, we means short for woman. We are. Dead means kill. So you put those two words together, you got wink dead, meaning kills woman. The person does not kill women. No, he doesn't do that. What he does is he keeps the lost tradition that women forgot. Today, women don't beadwork. They don't do quill work. They don't know how to make star blankets anymore. They can't tan buffalo hides. And they can't do a lot of the traditional work that they used to do. Well, we warriors went out and hunted and gathered what we could to bring them back, to take care of the whole nation as a whole. So the wink there, even him or her, we fed them. But we did not have sex with them. We did not sleep with them. We didn't do anything. We treated them with honor because they, too, hung on to traditional ways of life that women had forgotten. And that's the hard part. That's why their name, Winkste, means kills woman, when, in fact, they don't kill woman. They just hang on to the woman's last traditions, the lost traditions, because women, like I say today, this is 2021, December, what, 8th, 9th, somewhere around there? So when you look at that type of reality, what I'm, you know, trying to get people to pay attention to, the kills woman was honorable. So if we went out and got wild game, we brought him back. He or she brought him back, the same thing. And them Winksters, let me tell you, folks, man, they could skin a deer quick than the average male could, even though he's crossbred. Because in our culture, the Winkster had both a male and a female organ, vagina and penis. They were born that way. So it was an honorable thing. Those kind of things today, after being bastardized with Western culture's civilized mindset through English, we downgrade them. See, the English language is the most heinous language to ever obtain. It teaches you how to cuss, teaches you how to lie, and you're so good at using it to steal. And you also can get away with murder with it. Look at it. It's happening again. It's repeating itself. That's how heinous that language is. And so indigenous culture here on Turtle Island, on the other hand, we lived with honor. We only hunky he echa na hunky oyate ki he yuhapi. So we only hunky he isha taakulena unchi makhana wakhanchaka ki chi manete o spenicha ki he echa kawachi nit hunky he chizi ichache. Please forgive me, sister. I get that way at times. I didn't mean to go into my language. I apologize. Take full responsibility of that. I'm sorry I said that. It's an honorable thing what I said. As long as your heart can accept what's happening today, you will understand the gravitation of what the great mystery in Mother Earth had gave you. I mean, I love speaking my language, so that's why I went into that right away. I'm sorry. I don't like breaking it down, because if we're all indigenous people in the continent of Turtle Island, we should humble ourselves to know our language. We don't do that. We're like the white race today. We interrupt. We're loud. We're noisy. I mean, take a look at it. Wherever your surrounding is, go outside and see, man. These people are noisy. Man, they'll never want to return to serenity by getting in balance with nature. You won't walk around barefooted. You won't do none of that. But yet the four-legged and winged creatures are telling us two-legged to get our heads out of our behind and start smelling the real stink. And then you'll see where that balance needs to be. And that's to return back into the way we used to be, when we all knew how to think freely and independently. And I'll turn it back to you guys, because this is a beautiful show, sister. And thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I have a comment about language there. So as I learned Classic Greek years ago, I was stunned how much all words in Greek are organized according to gender. Then I wondered, when I was coming out as transgender, how much of that had to shape the European mindset to organize everything distinctly by masculine or feminine or neuter. Well, then I learned the Native American language of Anishinaabemowin, the language of the Michigan Turtle Island people. And that language does not divide things into gender, but it does divide things as animate or inanimate, living like a sin, rock, or ishkade, fire, living, but a piece of metal, not living. So it has a different ending. So they organize their mind as how it relates to nature, animate or inanimate, not by gender. So it seems like in Western culture, maybe gender got so overemphasized that nature counterbalanced, and now we have this transgender movement.
I tell you, it's all very interesting. I'm learning things more about this kind of culture than I've ever known before, and it's very interesting. And it's something that people need. I'm one for always learning about other religions and cultures and genders, because we're living in a world that was created in a very harmonious way. I mean, the colors around the world, the genders, the races, the religion, everything this is what makes the world, and this is what makes everything so beautiful. And people spend more time trying to not understand something that's different from them, but to try to destroy something that's different from them. And this is where we have a big mistake in this world, especially in this country, that there's too much wanting to destroy rather than wanting to embrace and wanting to learn more about it. Because everything has a history. Everything has a beginning. You know, every object, every person, every being, every animal, every fowl, whatever the case may be. So I'm really interested in what you have to say. And your idol here, Chinupa Duhamani from the Dakotas, you know, he's on with us, and he's talking a little bit about the cultures and the things that go on in this world too, in this country. So I will let you finish up what you were saying, Steph, and I'm sorry to keep interrupting all of you.
And I know, too, the pause was to now for take a deep breath and let others feedback while I reflect. Something that Chinupa touched on is very important, too, that within our deep culture, take a breath to listen and just to rest and not be talking all the time and listening. Something I learned while being in a circle. So one of the things I remember doing in a circle was like you know, I'm holding a feather, I talk. But when I'm done talking, I let from the left hand, I give that feather to the person sitting to the next to me who picks it up with his hand, and then I just listen. And I don't look at them. It's kind of different too. We look at the fire in the middle, and we do that, and we listen. And we do this year round. So talking about walking barefoot out in the middle, even in the winter sometimes. I remember my elder, I looked up to him, but one day we looked down, it's like, oh, wow, the elder is in January not wearing any shoes, just barefoot, walking around the circle. So yeah, so it's more like a connection with nature. So I had learned to be able to tolerate the cold and the heat, but realizing that our bodies are equipped to tolerate further ranges of heat and cold. But as modern persons, we get so comfortable living inside that we take it like we expect it. We're entitled to avoid cold or avoid heat. But our bodies were equipped to expand a great range of temperatures. How do we think the Inuit thrive up in the northern Arctic? So, yes, it's possible. Or even those who are living along the equator in the Amazon, they thrived. So we are equipped, our bodies are equipped to take much more pain that we allow it to. And there are a lot of rituals that our ancestors did and help encourage to be able to expand our tolerance for pain. So I've talked quite a bit about pain in the book. You need this because there is pain. And you think about it, what we often hate the most is not that we hate people or we hate what's different or we hate things that we don't understand. What we seem to hate the most is pain, because those that I don't understand, now I feel some pain. It's just uncomfortable and something I'm not used to. Well, I'm uncomfortable. And we end up hating the pain. But yet, the organic pain that first comes in, that's natural, I would say it's not something to hate or reject, but to embrace. It's something I learned to accept and appreciate, to even thank nature for the pain. It doesn't make it pleasant, but it sure makes it meaningful so that I allow the pain to go through me and not be pushing it away. Because if I don't allow it to go through me and process, then I can't find out what the pain is trying to do for me. So I learned that pain is just the body's way of reporting some kind of trouble to be removed. If I avoid the pain, I don't remove the trouble, and that trouble persists, stays there. But if I go ahead and embrace the pain, say, why am I feeling so much pain? If it's disappointment or if it's rejection, whatever that pain is, what is it I can accept or reject, or what I can do? What is my body telling me right now about my needs? And then I can respond to the need and to resolve it the best I can, and or communicate to others what they're affecting, how they're affecting me, those things beyond my control. So it makes it an opportunity to then to connect more deeply with others who are caught being a source of that pain. So I've learned to have a better relationship with pain. Now, I can tell you an interesting story about how this really came into sharp focus one day, right about this time of year. It was the last Sunday of November, 2004. This was my last year of incarceration. And I remember going out every Sunday at the Native American Circle. But this day, the temperature was 20 degrees, wind chill factor down in the single digits. And I was waiting for them to call over the radio, we're going to close the yard, we're not going to have circle. It's just too cold. That call never came. So I got into my blue-black jacket coat. Now, this is Michigan, and I could tell you that I worked in a garment factory, and I know what they call the winter coat was really little more than a windbreaker. So that's what we had to wear. And I remember I was going through this other course, too, to learn how to be in more connection with nature, to allow the cold to flow through me, to shiver for a moment, but then, you know, just take a deep breath, relax, allow the cold to just go right through me, because that's nature. That's intimacy with nature. So we went out to the circle, and the brother who was leading the circle, he smudges the brothers, that smudge, Bukwena Jagan, that he go ahead and light the four seasons. They got tobacco, cedar, wingash, sweetgrass, and some sage. And then he puts it all together, and we have a ritual. It's a cleansing process. It's a sacred part of the going into the circle. We all get smudged before we go into the circle. That was so cold. You have to take the glove off in order to hold the turtle shell of these herbs burning. It was so cold that he could only do two. So he left it, handed it off to his assistant. And he found it too cold too. So after two assistants, he looked at me because I was like the next one who could be entrusted with this. Well, I'm going through this learning about how I can endure extreme temperatures. And after two, I was like, okay, I'm going to hand it off back to the... But then something said to me, no, keep holding it. Endure. This will not kill you. And you know, and one of the famous quotes that you can hear from prisoners is from Nietzsche, whatever does not kill me makes me stronger. Well, I can apply that there too. So I went ahead and endured that. And so it was like two other brothers, four at all, before we were done. And then we all sat in circle. And I just relaxed my fingers. And my tip of my finger that was facing the bowl was actually burning. 1 centimeter away, the knuckles were getting frostbit. But I did not worry. I just relaxed. And I remember the next day, I could see my knuckles turning black from how cold it was. But I just relaxed, being part of nature. Don't freeze up. Don't go rigid. Stay relaxed. And within 3 days, it all cleared up, and I was never damaged by it. But I did learn a lot that I could tolerate a lot more pain, even the pain of prison, than I ever gave myself credit for.
Jeez. The pain of prison.
I wanted to get your name, the guy that was just talking that wrote the book that you need there.
Yes.
I had something that came up, but I feel really attached to you right now, and I really want to talk to you more if that's not a problem, but I was wondering if I could get your name.
Sure. My name is Steph Turner. It's also on so it's Steph Turner. That's actually intentionally gender neutral.
And is there a way I can get a hold of you, Facebook?
So at the end of this podcast, I'll be telling my website, and on my website is a contact. So you can go to my website, valuerelating.com, and there's a contact. You can always get a hold of me there.
Okay, say that again, because I have to jump offline. That's why I'm kind of reaching out right now. I hate to interrupt you guys, but I want to continue this conversation and talk to you more, but I have to go.
Yeah.
Not to you quicker than.
Value Relating, VALUE, Relating, RELATING, like one word, valuerelating.com.
Okay. Well, I'll be getting a hold of you. It was really good. You, just being on a line so far, you kind of really gave me an outlet because out here, there's not a lot of people that could be as proud as you are, especially going through prison and all that and being trans. I really look up to you.
Okay.
You inspired me a lot. You kind of picked my head up a little further than what it was today. You reminded me of why I am and what my purpose here right now.
Right.
And where I'm from is, you know, like I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm two-spirited. I exercise both feminine and masculine. And people all know
right.
it, but I wear stuff with pride. So those people that are turning to drugs and alcohol to try to cope with not coming out or not being comfortable with their skin, I too fell off the wagon. I was living in the streets last year. Now I'm 12 months sober, working on getting my own. But you gave me a remembrance of my purpose.
Right.
And
why we are who we are.
Yeah, it's just that I'm proud to be who you are and show them that you don't have to. I wear my sobriety as much as I do my pride being who I am. So I'm trying to exercise both at the same time. And, you know, I'm walking around town and I talk to people, but I try to show sober and I try to show my sobriety along with who I am. I'm two-spirited. it's okay to be sober and be who you are.
Right.
You know,
right.
And you showed me that. You remember you gave me a flashback of where I am. I don't even know how to say it right now, but.
I can catch you in your spirit. I sense what you're saying. Oh.
Yeah. So thank you so much. I'm glad I got your information.
Do either of you ever watch The Voice?
No, I don't.
You have to watch The Voice when you get a chance. There's a father and son on there now. The son was is a trans, and they've been on The Voice now, and they've been chosen every week. To be in the finals.
Mm-hmm.
So. You might want to watch that. And you watched one time on, I think it was America's Got Talent, where there was a young man, his parents turned against him because, you know, people turned against him because of his gender. And you know what? It turned out the whole audience, they all stood up. They all applauded him. They all supported him. And eventually his parents came, actually went to it, and they watched him, and they were so proud of him. So sometimes it takes awareness. And learning about these things in order to get people to finally be tolerant is very important. Acceptance is even more so important. So, Stephen, it was nice that you came on, and I think that you and Steph both bringing out this is something that needs to come out, because people can't live in a shell because they're feeling one way and not able to move. Like we talk all the time about worrying about what other people think and say. We've got so many people in this country, even in legislative members, that are so afraid to be themselves, speaking out about the injustices or whatever the case may be, because they don't want to lose their peers. It's not about your peers. Yeah. It's about you. You want to feel as comfortable as you can. So I just wanted to put that 2 cents in. And Chinupa or Steph or any of you.
Thank you guys for letting me talk and vent and listening and giving the feedback. It made me feel more comfortable to be on the line. So I just wanted to thank you and my uncle for letting me be on the line and expressing a little what I wanted to. And thank you, Steph, for the feedback and inspiring me, really. Like, you're a good thing for me today.
Let's keep in touch.
To you guys, and, I'll talk again next time you have.
Okay.
Next time you're on.
Right.
We'll have him on again, and you take care of that substance abuse issue you have. You know why? Because sometimes, and I say this all the time, we have an epidemic in this country of mental illnesses and substance abuse, and a lot of people think that people get involved with substances because they want to. But there's a lot of people in this country that get involved with substances to hide their own pain and traumas. So that's something, now that you're able to start getting this out and start feeling more about yourself, maybe you can start working on that issue easier now, okay?
Yeah. You really inspired to pick that up. And, you know, I have to walk to my grandbabies just a couple blocks down, but my head's a little higher and, you know, I have a little more pride showing in my, you know, my posture, my appearance outside.
You
empower me, so thank you guys.
You keep your head lifted. As it says in the Bible, judge not and you shall not be judged. And a lot of people that judge have to realize they will eventually be judged someday too. So you just keep your head lifted and you do what you have to do.
I'll you guys.
All right. Thanks for your input. Hopefully you're familiar with White Bison, too. So that's actually the organization that's really taking the lead on Wellbriety. That's Don Coyes' nonprofit organization, White Bison.
Well, Stephen's off the air now, but Chinupa, you have anything to say? We have another half hour, so you two can talk.
Yeah, you know, I heard, you know, the gentleman talk about the White Bison, you know. For many people, I just hope they're using it for the right terms. And the reason why I say that is because sometimes when people are finding sobriety, like my nephew and so forth, they look for ways to try to cope with some, even though they're still in it. I'm not trying to demean somebody's character. I'm not trying to dehumanize the person. What I'm saying is sometimes the harsh parts is the stereotypical behavior that come with those kind of things. But I will say this, you know, for a young man that's wrote his book and, you know, been incarcerated and so forth. You know, one of the things that a lot of our people take for granted is that the great mystery gave us a value. And that value is about how the turtle came about to secure this earth for us. But the great mystery decided to do this for himself because he too was alone. And everything written by civilized and modern man, it becomes a prelude in preventing you from understanding what your body can do as a natural healing organ. Because what I mean by saying because is that a lot of the earthly plants and, you know, vegetables that grow on it, those were our remedies to deal with what my nephew's going through. Alcohol never was here. Neither was marijuana. Neither was cocaine, meth. All that stuff was modern, created by civilized and modern man. Even the incarceration rate of people being locked up internally, okay? Because the way civilized and modern man work, I've learned this on my own. And it's not no theology, it's the reality of it. If we can't point the finger at them, but we lash out at things that are harming us, that's why they created prisons, to neutralize us from being who we are, from connecting back to the spiritual way of life, which is the earth mother, the great mystery, the air we breathe, the trees, everything that surrounds us. The indigenous culture is circular, okay, round.
Mm-hmm.
And many other people are square today. They walk straight line and all of a sudden they got to go right. They take off and they go all the way that way again. And then from when they get to that section, they go left.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all square, see? That's what they call what? Artificial, right? It's never in a harmonious virtue by going round and round and round and going back to the same place where you began. What I'm saying is to help people understand the artifacts of what violations are. When you violate your own physical being, you violate the great mysteries, you know, provisions he once gave you. And those are the things that people don't see today. I mean, we're going to talk a good game. We could talk everything that is so chronologically, you know, inclined to us, but let's really know who we are first. We are a people adapting somebody else's culture. And I heard you say something earlier that you and your sister did it first before you came along. And so you came along through your sister's virtue of looking at the internet and however you guys search your genealogy of who you are as native people and whatever, okay? You get on the machine's telling you that. Well, the machine can lie too, see? That's what they do anyway. But my point that I'm raising is, when you were really incarcerated, okay, because a reservation today in 2021 is still a prison camp. Ours is POW 344 here on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, Prisoner War Camp, you know, 344. And each one of the reservations has their own number, see? And that's still here, see? The American government, the military and all that, learned that from Hitler. And that's what Hitler was doing. So here we are in 2021 putting this message out there symbolically. There's no rituals because our people lost the whole reason to that. As you were saying earlier, you had a circle. You guys held on to a feather. Why were you guys holding on to that feather? You see? Because, you know, you need some kind of substance.
Big one.
To promote a balance. If you're holding that feather, why were you, young man? Why were you holding the feather?
It was part of the circle experience. I'm sure there's a lot more to it, but I can't think of
but,
it.
But you don't know why you were holding that feather, huh?
Miguan,
but you're indigenous, like you said. You said you guys just now, you learned to find out that your ancestries, man, indigenous people of the continent of Turtle Island, right?
Yes.
Okay, so but you don't know why you were holding that feather, huh?
I know why I was holding it, but you're going to tell me something else? Go ahead.
No, I'm going to tell you something else.
Okay, all right, I'm learning from you.
Okay, why were you holding the feather? If there were other indigenous brothers using that to promote some balance because of the incarceration, why were you holding the feather? What's the meaning of the feather?
Can I mention something to that?
Hold on. Sister, hold on, and then we'll let you get to it real quick.
Nupa, when you said I pass it on to you, that's when Steph mentioned that's what is done with the feather. When somebody is finished with something, they pass the feather on to the next person. I mean, that's the way I understood it.
Okay. So what I want to know from him, from an indigenous person, okay, this is where you talked about, you know, remember being very stereotypical and all this stuff. You said that, Leona, you did. But I'm not pounding that. No, I'm not pounding that. What I want to know from him, and I want him to learn about, is why were you holding the feather? What does the feather really symbolically mean?
Receiving the ears and attention of those so that they can hear what I'm saying, so that it's reciprocated. So when they hold the feather, I listen and connect with what they're saying. That's how it means to me. Plus
okay,
more,
that's how it means to you. Okay.
But it's probably a lot
all
more
right, that's your,
the first thing that comes to my mind.
Okay, so that's your prerogative. That's yours, okay? I'm going to disagree with it. Why?
Oh, I'm
going to tell you why. When you hold that sacred bird's feather,
mm-hmm.
you have to put the truth on that feather.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Okay, see, that should have came out of your mouth first. Don't add on. See, that's why I say the English language is very brutal, because we're going to all try to identify something to fit it. That bird, when we pray to him, and I'm going to only say it that way, that bird. So wambali gleska kile yecha yana ha etaha taku iwagla ke instaku wachak ke hena nuki ichu na ake wakata ke yana wakantha ka ichi mane tuki tuwa woche ke instaku iwogla ka ke hewana wakantha ka ichu ho hena echus wichoye onki trop he yanke as wane tuki le troksa hiki Mila husket kawo preki lena ata taksa eungna ke ata kashape hechse ka ol yomna yoncha dagne was taking up ke okisne. It's easier to say it in our language, knowing why we have this feather in the circle of life. The feather is an honorable thing to understand why we obtain them. For me, and I'm only going to speak for Chinupa, I obtained two whole eagles. And they were both golden eagles. I obtained them both. And however I was guided to them, I know where it came from, the great mystery. The great mystery showed me to both of those birds. They were killed by a white man, a white hunter. That's what the white man loved to do, kill everything. And so those carcasses of my brother, the eagle, were given to me, spiritually, mentally, physically, emotionally and otherwise. You see, that's the part that we don't get into anymore, because we've been cultivated and bastardized with Americans' way of life. We don't understand nature's, you know, involvement. We don't honor the bird.
We do not honor
the four-legged.
734.
Go ahead.
No, 734 just dropped. Steph, I would like to have you give the audience the information on your book, where they can find it, and any other information you want to get before we go on to the next caller that just called in.
Oh, sure. And right now, it's just about impossible for a new author to get to break through without relying on Amazon.com. I don't like Amazon, but I have to publish on Amazon.com to get started. And so that's where it's going to be published. But you can anyone who wants to find it, if you just first go to valuerelating.com, That way, when I decide that no longer Wicked available through Amazon and just self-publish or go somewhere else, you can still find it at valuerelating.com. And I have two other books to come up shortly thereafter.
I understand that. I saw that somewhere that you've written three books.
Yeah. So when I first wrote this book, I thought, this is the book. I looked on some videos online to help me learn about self-publishing, and this one woman was saying that her book was had too many pages to be published, to be printed into a print-on-demand through Amazon. Turns out there's a 550-page limit. I checked my book. It's like, yeah, it's too big, too. She divided her book into four. I divided mine into three. And I realized, too, it makes it easier for you to, like, read this book. And, okay, now I'm done with it. Now I'll be waiting for the next book rather than saying, wow, this book is too thick. I'm never going to get around to reading this.
Oh, those are good. That's a number of pages. Yeah.
So there's a tradition among, research has shown that the average book, when somebody buys it, they get past the first chapter, and a large number never get beyond the first chapter, never get to reading the second or third chapter. I had that in mind when I wrote the book. So I wrote the book not that it has to be read from start to finish, but to be written more as a reference book. So you can go from section to section and still be able to pick up things. And even though I use new terms, every new term is italicized, and you can look up the new term in the back of the book, the glossary. And at the end of the glossary, it shows where it's first introduced in the book. So I'm thinking of making it much more easier for everyone to just get to where they need to, instead of worrying about reading it from start to finish.
That's a good concept. We have another caller, 313. Oops, I'm sorry. I have you on mute. Okay, caller 313. You want to state your name, please?
This is Jabril. How you doing, Leona?
Good. How are you, Jabril?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. And hello to everyone out there in the listening audience and callers. Just tuned in and had some other conference calls, but I wanted to catch you guys on the show. So I'm just listening in at this point, just trying to catch up.
Well, we have Steph Turner, author and founder of Anoncology, and speaking on trials and achievements. Steph, you can explain a little bit about, what you were, and actually, I never did let you finish, so why don't you finish up what you were saying and maybe update everyone on what you were talking about earlier.
Which part was that? Because I don't remember where I left off.
I know, it's kind of confusing. But you were talking about the roller coaster journey that you've been on and the incarceration that you had to endure, the injustices, and your achievements since coming out of prison. And how long ago was it that you were in prison? When did you come out? When did you start writing your book? Just maybe give us some kind of background on that.
Sure. July 7th, 1993 was when we were both arrested, taken off to county jail, and I had not seen a day of freedom until September 22nd, 2005. Oh, you mentioned earlier about PRIA, the PRIA. That was actually passed into law 2003. So like 2 years before I get out, they finally make this a law. So I took this strategic course to detransition. Although inside, though, I was able to help counsel others who are in the same process, who are also not out as trans, but that's another story I could tell another time. We're helping other sisters who were presenting as brothers because it was safer that way back then. So I got out in 2005, January 2006, like 4 months later, I returned to school to finally finish up my undergrad because I had dropped out of undergrad way back in the 80s. So I finished that 2 years, then 3 years of master's, and another 3 years of master's. I was not able to finish my master's of counseling because of my background of a wrongful conviction of a sex offense that, even though it didn't occur, they go by the law. See, that's a whole other problem, too, that I'm challenging in the book. And that's another thing I'll be addressing even more so in the third book. But I'll wait for that to come out to cover that more ground. But then so in 2015, I finished up my internship as a counselor. Actually, it was early 2016. That was in north of Detroit. Then I moved to Kalamazoo, Michigan, to be with family, and I've been there ever since. And that's when I took the time to focus on writing my book, finally getting that done. but I kept getting certain interruptions. I had to deal with the wrongful conviction, and that's when I started working on projects like the Informed Decision Act. I had presented that bill to the local senator, one of my state senators, and he pretty much said in his own words, there's no real political will to drive this. So I started working on that, tried to form the political will, but then I started falling behind in my book, so I had to put that aside. And then there was a time where I ended up being scammed out of some money because this guy calls up claiming to be the sheriff and saying that I have to come up with money because there's a new law update and the sex offender registry. And that is ongoing challenges that the Michigan legislature is trying to redo the sex offender registry law because a U.S. district court shot it down, said it was unconstitutional, cannot be enforced. And so when I moved here to Kalamazoo 5 years ago, I stopped reporting. So technically I could be picked up and be facing a 2 to 4 year felony. But then the fact is that the courts don't really have much political will when this judge shot it down. Well, just recently, though, I became homeless. And in the condition to where living at a shelter, I had to go back to reporting. And that's actually what I did yesterday afternoon, which is why I couldn't listen or call in on yesterday's show, because I was downtown resuming my reporting. And I'm going to do a follow-up on that, saying here are the costs, here are the impacts of forcing me to do this. Because one of the major reasons I had stopped reporting the first time, it was a moral quandary. Here I am, I'm wrongly convicted of aiding abetting a sex offense, but yet the state is committing a sex offense, if you broaden the term of sex offense, against a transgender person. By the way, I'm also asexual. I never had sex with anyone other than my then wife. Yet that doesn't matter in the courts because reality is not what they base on. It's just who wins in court. So as of yesterday, I had to go back and comply with the law, even though the law totally does not fit my situation. But I'm going to use this opportunity to build a relationship with them and to say, here is the reality. Oh, and by the way, I wrote a book about this. Read the book. You Need This. I think it's a good title, huh? You Need This. So anything else you'd like to mean? I could follow up on some other things, too, if you like.
That's the name of the book. I was on mute. I was trying to get off of mute. But what I was going to ask you is you mentioned that your mom died.
Oh, yeah. She passed away in 2012, right after I'd earned my first master's degree. In fact, she was struggling with, I think it was breast cancer, and so she was not able to actually make it. She saw me walk when I got my bachelor's degree, so at least, she was there. But she did not survive long enough for me to know that I went on to get my second master's degree. But she walked home. She was actually struggling in pain for most of her life. So I thought it was a good that she walked on.
Well, she got to see some of the achievements that you made before passing on.
Right. If you can imagine the pain, emotional pain she was in 1993 when she learns two of her four kids are now incarcerated for a crime. She had no idea why would we be accused of something like that. So, yeah, she went through a lot of emotional pain.
That's the injustices that go on in this country, and that's why I bring it up all the time, because people need to be aware that there's many wrongful convictions. There's many first-time offenders who were victims before becoming offenders, first-time offenders that were never involved with the law, with drugs or anything, and going to prison, and so many of them went in when they were under the age of 25 and are still in at the age of 85. It's ridiculous.
Right.
That's the country we live in. And I just recently, that's another one. But I just recently learned in Washington, D.C., that a prisoner who was still incarcerated was recently elected into government.
Oh, okay. I missed that he was still incarcerated. I've heard of people coming out and becoming politically involved.
He's become an elected official in Washington, D.C. His name is Joel Gaston. He is 44 years old. He won the race for an advisory neighborhood commissioner for District 7F07 in Southeast D.C. So it goes to show you that even while incarcerated, people are found worthy to achieve and obtain these positions. They can't be all that bad. So why is the government keeping people incarcerated? I have no clue to what it's all about.
I wanted to add, too, that this is something I'm sure your audience is well aware, but that when someone does the time, their family does the time in their own way along with them. They're not incarcerated, but they are going through a lot of emotional pain. They have their own trauma. They have their own struggles. Especially, I was the breadwinner. My wife at that time was at work at home mom. She could not be that anymore. She was very active with our kids, but she had to step away and allow others to take over. And now I see the impact on that on my adult children. They're all adults now, and they have kids of their own. So I see this generational abuse. And by the way, that's one of the things White Bison, with Don Coyce and White Bison, address is the generational abuse that goes through Indian country, through the boarding school era, and the native elders who were struggling with all this pain and shock and the culture ripped from them. So that all goes on now, even in the black community, where someone who was wrongly targeted back in the 1970s, now they have grandchildren, really great-grandchildren, who are going through some of the same thing because the system does not deal with needs. It does not address needs. It addresses its own institutional needs for its own self-perpetuation, but that's not a legitimate use of an institution. And that's something else. I don't address that so much in this book, but I do in the third book.
I'm glad you're bringing awareness to the book. I really need it because you said it might serve their purpose, but it's not serving the purpose of those
right.
Of their families.
In sociology, we learned about what's called the Iron Law of Oligarchy. Came up with a sociologist from 100 years ago, and he realized that institutions start out on a noble purpose. Here's our mission. We're going to help these people do this. Now, you can include in that, too, the institution of police. Now, the modern institution of police began in Great Britain in 1829. And since then, even though it started out with these noble goals, we tend to drift from those noble goals, and now the institution is doing more to help keep itself going at whatever cost. Now, if the public is scared into thinking that we cannot have a safety unless we have these people in uniform carrying around these weapons and using the exclusive use of violence for the state, then what can we do in the alternative? I think that's often missing in the public rhetoric about defund the police, because those who are saying defund the police are really saying reimagine what it's like to be safe in your own communities without these people coming across or half across the city and thinking that they're going to help you when they actually just often make situations worse. So that's a little bit too I'm addressing in the book, is rethinking how these institutions exist first to serve needs, but then how do we keep them accountable? So I'm actually raising the whole idea about gynecology actually raises the bar, raises the standard. So when the police comes and does this action, what is the result upon our needs and their needs? And if it only serves their needs and actually damages our needs, then it lacks legitimacy.
You know, I'm for defunding, sorry. I'm for defunding, and I let everybody know that. And a lot of people say they need more training. They need money because they need more training. It's not about training. As I say all the time, it's about morals. It's about the bringing up. And there's a lot of people in law enforcement and in the penal system who were raised to have a lot of hatred and vengeance and violence in them. And I think that's why a lot of people go into law enforcement and go into correction officers and officials, because they know they can get away with it.
Yes, interesting. In 2013, right about the time we heard from Edward Snowden about the nasty things the NSA was doing, well, we also learned from a report that there was a large number of police officers were being hired from Iraqi war veterans. They had served in Iraq. But then what they hadn't known was that a large number of these Iraqi veterans had been survivors of improvised explosion units. And that those explosions happened close by, and that some of them actually had brain damage because of it. And that brain damage, and I had 2013, by the way, is when I was in my second master's degree about counseling, and I had a course to learn about TBI, which is a traumatic brain injury. So it was talking about police officers who actually had traumatic brain injury, and those who have this TBI often can cry in a rage. The smallest thing can really offend them, and they can act very violent. In fact, football players can even be subject to this, because about that time, there was this Frontline PBS documentary called A League of Denial that talked about how concussions that are being endured and suffered by football players had lifelong damaging effects. Well, that was also happening by our police officers. So whatever became of that news report, I often wondered, did it suddenly become silence? Like, this is an inconvenient truth, so let's change the story. But we still probably have police officers who are recruited from the Afghan war who have suffered TBI or other traumas, and those traumas often act or become unloaded when they engage typically a young black male and don't deal with them according to their needs, but according to their own fears.
Yeah.
So I think that's another – go ahead.
I was just going to say there is so much to learn. There's so much awareness that needs to be brought out and so much that people just don't know. I'm learning so much from this interview today. There's a lot of things that I really didn't even know about. This is very informative.
Okay. And for right now, the dominant narrative is that because we are a democratic nation, we elect our officials, and that every 4 years or every 2 years or whatever the election cycle is, we can vote in or vote out those who represent us. But of course, we all know that money has severely distorted the election process, and other institutions like mass media have severely distorted who and what our representatives really do. So one of the things coming out of Onycology that I aim to do is to democratize democracy, to be able to say, everyone, here's how this police officer impacted me, or here's how this court finding impacted me, or this is how this landlord who's threatening to evict me is impacting me. Here is the full story. This is how I'm, and how am I impacting them? Keep it equal. So it's always equal. So it isn't, so it's another way of speaking truth to power. And so I have a whole process about that. I eventually want to develop and unfold. But honestly, I want to first share it with Miriam because I know she's into psychosocial therapy. The whole area of what I'm talking about actually falls under what I call psychosocial therapy because so much – I mean, I took a degree in counseling, but all of it was so much focused on the individual. But what's often what we're experiencing is not just something from the individual, but from the environment, from the social world around us. And those things need to be addressed too. So I'm trying to develop a process to develop, you know, to confront or challenge or question all these outside factors that are keeping us from being totally well. Or as Chinupu was talking about wellness or how we were originally designed to be at one with Mother Earth. Modernity has upset that balance. Onycology has the potential to find a road path, find a path for everyone to find restored. Now, within Indian country, we call it the red path, but that's very culturally specific. I try to keep this within the social science realm, but also, you know, respective of different cultures, even respective of a New Testament, you know, of the Bible. If you want, you could go through Onycology, the book, and you won't find anything that's contradictory to what I already know about the Bible. And I have a degree in theology, so that's why I can say that. So, yeah, so I hope the book can really be very impactful to others. They get something out of it, and hopefully with others, too, because I'm not the only one who's trying to deal with all these modern problems. But modernity right now is a major issue right now that's confronting a lot of us. There's a point where modern convenience has been nice, but it's also come with a great cost, and we are now facing a lot of these costs. Well, one big cost is that if we become emotionally attached to different modern conveniences, what do we do when those conveniences are taken from us, whether through climate change or climate collapse or through economic collapse? Or more meaningfully, what if I find out that the minimalists are right, and then my life would be more meaningful if I had less than half of what I own right now? How are we going to adjust? Well, Onycology, the study of need, helps to provide a path to make that transition. And I even put this in the introduction that there is going to be probably an imminent grand contraction where we all get compelled to return to the Native American connection, to a connection to the Mother Earth, realizing that we experience needs because they are the result of nature. Because, you know, we often grow up with the idea that nature is outside. The indigenous worldview is that we are part of nature. I am nature. You are nature. Nature is a big connection, a web of life. We are all connected. And so when we get too attached to conveniences that pulls away from nature, it may feel good in the short term, but after a while, some consequences come due. And now those consequences are coming due.
I'm glad you're bringing all this up because I say this all the time. I've been to 11 third world countries. So they don't call them third world anymore because everybody's coming up in the world. But I have learned how to survive in a time when there's a lot of poverty. The Indians, and you just said it, and Chinoop is back with us, so he can say it. And Jabril, the Indians have lived the land. So when it comes right down to a crisis in this country where people are going to have a hard time surviving because the economy, we're in inflation or whatever the case may be, we know how to survive. You know, somehow, we know. I remember years ago growing up on Cape Cod where there was a selectman from Yarmouth who went bankrupt, and he ended up killing himself. They found him, he shot himself in his office because he didn't know how to survive that crisis. We live in this country all about money and power. So when this crisis hits, and this country is going to be in a crisis because it's predicted in the Bible, the whole world, are they going to be able to survive? Because they're so about money and power and fame and corruption and all this stuff. Who's going to be able to survive but the Indians themselves, the natives, who have lived, and as you just said, nature is not just out there. It's in you. It's in the Native Indians. So they know how to survive in any situation at all. And so many others who have lived in poverty or have learned to live with little to nothing will know how to survive. And if you or Chinupa or Jabril want to mention something about that, please feel free to go.
I'm just going to quick add, this is something I put in my third book because I had to split it. But we use the word power kind of loosely because in the social sciences, we speak of power as really influence. But the point is, from an indigenous point of view, power is much deeper, much more powerful, much more central to existence. So I put in there, power is not really power unless it resolves needs. Otherwise, it's just coercive force. The government is not power. Jeff Bezos is not power. He's powerless. If he had power, all our needs would resolve. There's no such thing as power in the conventional modern sense. But I end up using that term because that's what we taught and that's what people understand. But real power is nature existing to bring us all into balance to resolve each need that we experience. And when our needs don't fully resolve, then we have missed the power of nature. And we experience pain.
Let me jump in here before we go any further with this. This gentleman, again, I'm going to share something with you, young man.
Sure.
If you're using the indigenous way of life, okay, please, please refrain it from putting it in a book, okay? Please. We're not told to do that stuff. All cultures that are indigenous are told not to do that. Okay? And earlier in this conversation, in this radio broadcast, I said the English language was brutal, barbaric. It's no good. We talk. You guys all like to talk. But I will say this, and then I'm going to get off the phone because I'm hearing you go on, and now I'm getting offended because I was hoping my little brother Jabril Salam came on, but he said he was dealing with some other stuff. I disagree with that.
I know
he's on. I heard him, okay? But he said he was dealing some stuff, okay? I'll deal with that another time. So I'm going to share this. And that's I'm going to leave it at that. And when that other guy, Joe, comes on, I'm going to wait for Joe because I want Joe. Anyway, this is what I'm going to give you. E hane wa khantanka kichi mane tu na unchi makha kile wo suta unkupi wi choye ogna na takule no uspe unkya piki hena echa toeni o wa pi khanki kya tima e agna ki kishni toeni hechu echi echum shnyo hech ano kichi chawa la kokte e ap Ho yung khawana wane to ki isam leches e unki apina. Li la ota mila hasket ha wichoye thopi waste la kapi. He un sa tagni waste ichumbo kipni. Naha lechalakis e chungsi mit khaki iwogalake. Wakhat khakat kha pikle mila haska e chet ke oa pikke heslo kie. So henna ep as me tagne helo mo de oa kisne. Che takomene ni lakhota. Ke a hesus e iwagalake weogna. Che eta ha tako uchicha kinkte kile elcha khawachi ogna. Toni hesus e Oa pikilina, inigwana hepki ma yagna ko yaki kisnik doane. Chakik suya po, ampetu onji hexis in the hachti, weagla koki. Duat hoxa hyukti na wa enik enkina, sicha enigna kikte, na ha hez nis enslo yankte. Doani lexis emila haskat hawob hekile, doani anafta najibo yaki kisne. Chakia hexis epkikina, oaste chichupi. For the lateral part of people that were listening in the audience, okay, I gave you my language to describe why I felt that way. And we are told, even the Great Mystery said this, don't put this in the book. Because books weren't here in Turtle Island. They never were. See, the white man brought them here. And here we are. We're so critical to use them things. If I go to any other country, which I've been to different countries, I didn't get involved with what English had or the Brits had. I didn't get involved with that. I got involved with what the indigenous people were doing over there. That's what I did. And it was honorable. I could see it. I could reflect to it. Because over here, we struggle just to remain that title in it. And we're forgetting who we are. And so I wanted to say that much because be careful on what you're putting in these books, young man. It's going to harm. We're going to end up like Joel. The guy that always calls in when he found a way to get in now. He found a way to get in. And so I'm going to refrain from that and back up. But thank you again, sister, for allowing me to come on. And this young man for speaking on his books. And we'll see you guys again in another show soon. You're welcome to come on our show, too. We have a show every Friday and Saturday. Same number, 657-383-1630 from 5 o'clock. Mountain time to 6:30 in the evening, both Friday and Saturday. You're welcome to come on that show. So just like my nephew.
Before you leave us, I wanted to say one of the things about putting it in the book, though, is, you know, when you do your speak your native language and everything, you're teaching a lot of your own, the native Indians that don't know, the young ones that don't know the language, that don't know their culture as much as, you know, you want them to. Putting it in a book it may be out there, others may see it, but look at all the young people or the people of the native, even in my own family. I mean, my mother was Lebanese. None of us speak the Arabic language or the other languages that we have. So it's good for these young people that are going to be reading this book, or even the older ones that don't know enough about their culture, to learn about some of these things too. I just feel like it would help. It would help them.
It might help, okay, but here's the catch. You're going to kill the meaning. That's why it's deadly. We can't do that. It's gonna. You're going to kill the meaning. That's why language is guttural pronounced, okay? Today, these people today, and I'm just reflecting to you guys on that matter. I'm calling you guys these people today that have that, obtained the traditional language, okay? They're the ones that are putting it out there to do that.
We've been eating
more of the white man's way of life. Now we're thinking and behaving like him. How is tradition going to constantly grow and prevail if we don't give it to our grandkids like I do? Okay? See, that's the thing. I teach them word by mouth, the way education was taught in the teepee of my grandpa's house when I was raised. That's where education comes from, your teepee. So I'm only using the house it never was written. It was handed down word by word, by mouth, because it was honorable that way. Our language doesn't lie, and our language does not have any cursing in it. So then when you put it in a book, people are going to interpret in a different view. You can't do that. But see, that's how it is. We are told not to do that, but here we are. We're doing it. Incarceration is the most deadliest thing to ever acquire with anybody. I've been in there, so I know what I'm saying. But I never, ever took on any faith that was inside there because the institutions give you that. You can follow any faith that's in there. I never did. I stuck with my own. And that's how I created a brotherhood with people that surrounded me. And it was mainly the black people and my Mexica people from Mexico that stood together. Those three colors of man in there stood together. And we knew how they were, their people were. We knew how that because they all work with the system. That's why the word snitch became the way they are in them place. You couldn't trust them. That's why we had our own way of dealing with it.
We are out of time.
That's the hard part.
We are out of time now. So, again, Chinupa Buhamani, they will have their show on Friday and Saturday. It's at 5 o'clock their time, 7 o'clock Eastern time. And anyone that wants to go on and pick up where they left off here, please feel free to do so. Stephanie, I want to thank you for being on the show with us. I really welcome you coming on. I'm going to try to order that book. I want to know more about it. So when it comes out, and also we'd like to have you back on the show again. But as Chinupa said, to join them on their show on Friday or Saturday. And
Come on. Thank you, sister.
I want to thank all of you for being on. Thank you, Chinupa, for coming on, and Jabril. And Steph, again, thank you so much. You brought so much awareness to me, and I really enjoyed having you on.
Great. Thank you much.
Thank you, Leona.
Thank you, Jabril. And we will have you back on again, Steph. I'm going to, right now I'm kind of booked until the end of December, but hopefully the beginning of January to have you come back on again as well.
All right.
Audience, we are going to be closing down now. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and we look forward to having you back on tomorrow. I will be doing an interview at 8:30 a.m. in the morning with Carlos King, an incarcerated individual who was wrongfully convicted. And then Friday, we will be interviewing at 1 o'clock, Sandy Freese, who is the author of The United States and Justice System. Sandy Freese, a life coach therapist, will be on with us then. Thank you all again, and thank you again, Steph, and we look forward to the next time you come on the show. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.